Hi, I'm Marvin Allnay, and this is To The Point. Impeachment of President Trump is increasingly likely, led by Nancy Pelosi's Democratic majority in the House of Representatives. The next step is trial in the Senate, where Republicans have enough members to prevent the two-thirds vote the Constitution requires for conviction. But despite mounting evidence, those Republicans are either silent or standing by their man. And that's creating a major division in the GOP. Here is the former Secretary of State, Colin Powell.
The Republican Party has got to get a grip on itself. Right now, Republican leaders and members of the Congress, both Senate and the House, are holding back because they're terrified of what will happen to any one of them if they speak out. Will they lose a primary?
Once again, Colin Powell, the former Secretary of State under George W. Bush. Quinn Hillier is a conservative columnist. He's at the Washington Examiner. He's a 40-year veteran of the conservative movement. He's also a contributing editor to the National Review online. Quinn Hillier, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren. Glad to be with you.
What do you say to what we just heard from the former Secretary of State?
Well, in this case, Colin Powell is right. The senators, at the very least, should be withholding judgment, like Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska said he is. He said, let's let the facts come out. Other senators and certainly House members who are out there vociferously defending the president and attacking the Democrats right now are not doing their job, which is either on the House side akin to sort of a grand jury or on the Senate side akin to a jury. They are prejudging the case, and that is not what their constitutional duty is and not what their moral obligation is.
Why do you think they're doing it? We just heard Colin Powell suggest that maybe they're afraid of losing a primary.
Colin Powell is right. That is, I think, exactly what they fear. And they also fear that even if they get by the primary, that if they do not defend Trump strongly enough, that a lot of their voters will be so dispirited that they will not show up to vote to help them beat the Democrats in the fall. So either way, they're afraid of losing office, and that tends to drive a lot of political calculations. I happen to think that calculation is wrong, but that's what they are thinking.
To what extent do you think they're worried about immediate retaliation by the president himself if, in fact, they say something negative? To what extent do they fear the voters?
Well, the only retaliation the president can give them is, or almost the only that he can give them, is indeed to come out and criticize them, bash them on Twitter or something like that. But what that does is it hurts their standing with the voters, which leads us back to the first point, that if their standing is hurt with the voters, they might not get reelected. And that's what they fear. Again, I think their fear is overblown, but it is there and it is very real for them, at least in their own minds.
Quinn Hillier with the Washington Examiner and the National Review. Tim Miller is also with us. I think I heard a chuckle from him a moment ago.
I never would have expected to hear Quinn agree with Colin Powell twice in one segment there just a couple years ago.
He's a contributor to The Bulwark, a communications consultant, previously senior advisor to the anti-Trump group called Our Principles PAC, and communications director for Jeb Bush. Remember him. You were also a spokesman at one point for the Republican National Committee. Go ahead, chime in here and tell us what you think.
Well, sure. Look, I think Quinn is right about the motivations here. You know, everybody is making short-term political calculus, you know, rather than moral or ethical calculus or potential long-term political calculus. I think a lot of these senators expected Trump to lose in 2016. They were wrong. And now they're scared of their own shadow. You know, they felt like they got out against him maybe a little bit too aggressively after the Access Hollywood tape and don't want to make that same mistake again. Most of the caucus went out and opposed him after that and then had the limb chopped off behind them. And so I think that is what's driving a lot of this access. And I think a feeling of being in the mix, of being able to persuade the president. This is irrational, obviously, as most significantly noted by Lindsey Graham, who came up with this calculus of, okay, well, I'll completely change my position on Trump. I'll suck up to him. I'll golf with him. And that way I'll be able to convince him to move him towards my neocon foreign policy preferences. That strategy has been a complete failure. But yet I think that, you know, Senator Graham feels like both from the, you know, political side of getting reelected in South Carolina, as well as, you know, feeling like he has influence, even if it's for naught, you know, this is the best path forward for him.
I want to talk more about foreign policy, but first, you used some interesting terms. You said moral and ethical, and you said long term. How are they distinguished from long term?
Well, sure. I was distinguishing long-term from short-term political calculus, firstly. I meant that, you know, I think the short-term political calculus, it's hard to argue for a Republican, is to stick with Donald Trump. I think it's an open question if that's the correct long-term political calculus. You know, I think that completely separate from that political calculus is making a moral, you know, stand and standing up for the, you know, principles of why you, A, became a Republican, but, you know, your duty to uphold the Constitution. And, you know, I think that in the past, we have seen in less polarized times when the parties were not sorted as clearly, you know, we saw, you know, at the Bulwark, Charlie Sykes wrote about, you know, Margaret Smith during the Joe McCarthy hearing, taking a stand against the, you know, rest of the Republican caucus and saying this is wrong. You're not really seeing that from anybody now, except for Mitt Romney, who I think is somewhat inoculated from the political side of things because of the unique politics of Utah. And so, you know, I think that is what is missing from this. Nobody, you know, has been willing to say both, I'm going to take the moral stand and I'm going to fight this political fight. You know, people are either taking the moral stand and then leaving, like Jeff Flake, or, you know, going along to get along with Donald Trump.
Quinn Hillier, back to you. Do you see this as well as a moral and ethical issue in addition to the political one?
Yes, I think it's all three. It is definitely a moral and ethical issue. Look, anybody, like a lot of these House members, especially those in leadership who are out there vociferously attacking Democrats, they have to know in their heart that the president, at the very least, has entered a very disturbing gray area. Whether it's impeachable or not, they can argue. But for them to say that the president did nothing wrong or decidedly unusual in pressuring a foreign country to go after his political rivals, that is an utter renunciation of morality and ethics to say that there's nothing wrong with that at all. And they are not living up to their duty as decent people, much less their duty to the Constitution, if they completely ignore this really bizarre behavior by the president. Then again, I also want to say that what Tim said about the long-term calculations being different, I think he's right about that. I've got a column out right now saying they should remember the lessons of Watergate. Throughout 1973, almost every Republican vociferously defended Nixon. Turned out more facts came out. Nixon was guilty, and Republicans had a bloodbath in 1974. These Republicans now are putting themselves in that exact same circumstance, and it's really short-sighted of them.
Tim Miller, back to you. What about Mitch Romney? You mentioned him a moment ago. What role do you think he, from what you suggest, is a sort of insulated position because he's a senator from Utah, what role do you think he's trying to carve out for himself?
You know, look, I think that in the cliched terms, you know, the one honest man in the last honest man in the caucus. But, you know, look, I think that he wants to have influence. You know, Mitt, who I admire a great deal, is definitely a person of you know, ethics and morals, but has not exactly, you know, demonstrated a tendency towards getting out on the limb and being extremely, you know, maybe aggressive or courageous in a political sense. You know, he is moral, of course, but he's cautious. And so I think that he's going to want to work behind the scenes with senators. He wants to see the evidence come out. And if there is enough evidence that points to conviction, do his best to lobby behind the scenes while making, I think, tempered, you know, public remarks. You know, I don't see him, you know, maybe waving a bloody shirt and you know, kind of leading the resistance against Donald Trump or primarying him or anything of that nature. So I think that is where he sees his role. I feel like he could maybe have some room to be more aggressive than he's willing to be, but I think that is, you know, kind of what is in Mitt's nature.
Do you think his long-term goal might be to replace Donald Trump as the leader of the Republican Party, whether he does it in a primary or waits for impeachment or waits for the next election?
I mean, maybe in his, you know, most optimistic of dreams, that thought crosses his mind. But I really don't think so. I think that he wants to do the honorable thing. I think he wants to represent the state of Utah. You know, he already had a swing at this. I do think that he believes that he can be a kind of elder statesman that sort of points the party back the right direction and helps groom, you know, somebody else coming up from behind to lead the party. I definitely think he would think that is a more realistic, you know, success path than you know, taking back the party altogether.
Hasn't he bounced back and forth, maybe not as dramatically as Senator Graham, but he was very critical of the president during the primaries. He then attempted to become the Secretary of State and seemed to be getting along nicely. Now he's moving the other way, giving President Trump the opportunity to call him a loser and saying, you know, you tried it and you couldn't do it, and consequently you ought to shut up.
Yeah, like I said, look, Mitt is cautious. You know, Mitt was never going to lead the resistance against Trump. I think he made a political calculus that Trump was you know, not viable as a president when he came out as aggressively as he did during the primary. That ended up being wrong. So I don't expect him to make that same move again. You know, I think that he wanted to try to balance kind of maintaining his integrity with having influence, with maintaining his conservative principles. That's tough in this era. So, you know, I don't think that there are any heroes right now in the Senate Republican caucus. I think that he has the most room to be one. Not even anywhere in the ballpark of Lindsey Graham, though, who is out there literally spouting conspiracy theories, you know, about the fact that the Ukrainians might have ended up being the ones that interfered in the 2016 election. Graham is off the deep end, so I wouldn't even put him in the same league as Romney.
What about the president's conspiracy theories? What do you know about those?
Well, sure. I wrote about that for the Bulwark this week. And, you know, I don't think we have enough time on this podcast for me to explain, you know, everything that I went through for your listeners. So I'd encourage them to read it. But what I tried to do is take at face value the president's claims about Ukraine, the attorney general's investigation into the origins of the Crystal Steel dossier. And I tried to put them all together in one narrative to demonstrate just how outlandish and absurd what they're putting forth is. You know, it's all of these little items that seem like they could be true, right? You know, maybe Christopher Steele was working with the Democrats. You know, maybe there was, you know, the DNC didn't let the FBI look at their servers. That does seem weird. You know, maybe this, maybe that. And on each of these little points, I think the president, who does not have a, you know, narrative mind, you know, he is just throwing stuff against the wall, so to speak. And so I don't think he's trying to put together a narrative. But his allies, Rudy Giuliani, you know, his campaign, his, you know, the writers at Breitbart, the Federalist, and these pro-Trump outlets, try to backfill his claims and demonstrate these absolutely absurd theories, you know, where the DNC was working with Comey and Brennan and four different countries, intelligence agencies to seed the Steele dossier. And then they let the DNC leak happen so that they could, you know, pin it on Russia and then have the Ukrainians, you know, actually cover it up. I mean, it is an absolutely insane, absurd series of events. And I think that what the president tries to do is just dribble out these little claims that maybe seem defensible. And he's got people like Lindsey Graham, you know, out on a limb on this. And I think if you're an honorable senator, if you are a senator, people who we thought used to be mainstream Republicans and honorable people, you know, your choice right now is either be quiet, do what Marco Rubio does and say this is all a joke, or go whole hog like Lindsey Graham and Josh Hawley and others and really buy into, you know, these offensive, honestly, conspiracy theories about our intelligence community that undermine really the security of, you know, our country and our elections going forward if we can't just, you know, say what it is when it comes to Russian interference in the election.
We began talking about the process involved, with the House being the institution that charges the president and the Senate being the grand jury, the jury, whatever you want to call them, that has to convict. And Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has been saying that if the House sends over the articles of impeachment, of course, he'll put them up for a vote. And yet, he's now put out an advertisement in his own campaign for re-election in Kentucky. It's apparently an online ad, so the audio isn't that great. But let's listen to that.
Nancy Pelosi's in the clutches of a left-wing mob. They finally convinced her to impeach the president. All of you know your Constitution. The way that impeachment stops is when a Senate majority, with me as majority leader. But I need your help. Please contribute before the deadline.
Quinn Hillier, back to you. What does that mean when the impeachment process stops because of the Senate majority leader? What's he talking about?
This is disgusting. He is raising money, raising campaign cash, by saying that he is going to kill the move to remove the president before he has heard the facts, before he has seen what the impeachment inquiry comes up with, before he has seen the House actually pass any articles of impeachment. He says he will kill them. And he says, because I will kill them, I want you to give me campaign cash. This is graft. This is despicable. And I am ashamed to have ever been a member of a party whose leader would do something like this. I'm flabbergasted, and frankly, I think even though it's probably not removable from office in itself, I think it is worthy of consideration of censure by the full Senate. That's how strongly I feel about it.
Tim Miller, I know you need to leave us. Any final comment you want to make?
You know, look, Mitch McConnell has made his bed with this. And I think once you've decided that you're going to ride with Donald Trump, you know, he drags you down into the muck. He drags you down with these conspiracies. He's taken a lot of good people, or people who I think thought that they were going to be ethical public servants, and turned them into, you know, essentially grifters, as Quinn said. And, you know, it's really been sad to see, and I've been happy to be with you to discuss it.
All right, Tim Miller, a contributor to The Bulwark, also a former communications director for Jeb Bush and spokesperson for the Republican National Committee. Listening into all of this, Corey Brettschneider, he's a professor of political science at Brown University, visiting professor at Fordham Law School. He has newly released a book entitled Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. Professor, great to have you with us.
Thanks. Pleasure to be part of this conversation. And I'm heartened by what I've been hearing.
Okay. Chime in. I want to hear from you, particularly about the mechanism referred to by the majority leader of the Senate in his ad. Do you find it as disgusting as these conservative Republicans do?
Oh, absolutely. And I fully endorse the idea that this is a dereliction of duty. And I do think, without question, it's worthy of censure. The Constitution creates obligations on all of the branches of government to act. And even when courts, as in this case, don't enforce those obligations, and I don't expect any intervention by the Supreme Court in this process, it still is the fact that the Senate has an obligation to try the president if articles of impeachment are voted by the House. And that assumes that there's going to be a process that includes a serious look at the facts. Now, we're not in a criminal process. It's distinct. The standard is not, for instance, beyond a reasonable doubt. There's no requirement that a crime has been committed, although that's certainly part of what a president might do to so degrade the oath that he is guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors. But certainly there's a basic obligation of the Senate to consider the accusations, to weigh the evidence, and to allow senators to vote their conscience. And so to really try to bypass that process before looking at it is about as grave a constitutional violation as we can get. And the system relies on basic duties being pursued by each of the branches, again, even if courts aren't forcing them to do so. So, you know, this is the stuff of constitutional crisis when a leader puts partisanship in such a naked manner above constitutional duty.
What do you think about the way that the House is proceeding and focusing, as they are, so narrowly, if that's the right term, on what was going on between the president and the president of Ukraine?
I think that the focus on the call makes sense in that Americans understand that there was wrongdoing here and possibly a crime. So as a start, yes, I think that's right. But I think it's a disservice to the process also to suggest that this is the only thing that they're going to look at. Certainly, the question of high crimes and misdemeanors in the impeachment inquiry, for instance, in Andrew Johnson's case or in Richard Nixon's case, looked at a pattern of abuse of power. And my worry is that I don't want to see the House Democrats fall into a trap that suggests that they have the burden of showing that a crime was committed. That is part of it, and I could see that being a first possible article of impeachment. But I think the inquiry has to be broader than that. It has to be about abuse of power, including obstruction of justice in Part 2 of the Mueller report. That's certainly relevant. The question of negligence in reporting Russian interference in the election, I think, is relevant, as are the president's many emoluments violations, the use of the office for profit, really contradicting not just the clauses of the Constitution that prohibit that, but the original inaugural address by George Washington, who defined the office precisely as being for the public good, not for personal profit.
Let me ask you about Gordon Sondland. He's the ambassador to the European Union. He flew in from Brussels to appear before a House committee this week, only to be told the State Department was canceling his testimony. How important was that?
Well, when we broaden the inquiry, when we think about high crimes and misdemeanors, as we need to, as abuse of the office and a violation of the oath, that's the argument that I end my book with in considering impeachment, dating back to the British law of offices, that defying subpoenas and the rightful power of Congress to get information pursuant to its powers is itself an abuse of power and potentially, if it's ongoing, an impeachable offense. And that was part of the argument against Richard Nixon, that the defiance of the basic mechanisms of checks and balances were themselves an abuse of power. And so, you know, the way that Trump acts in the midst of this inquiry is itself has to be under scrutiny. So when he invites China to intervene in our politics, that's also, you know, even though he's trying to show that it wasn't such a big deal, that he invited the Ukrainian government to give information on a political adversary, that's not something that we can just ignore. All of these things have to get added in. Now, narrowing down what we're going to focus on, that's going to be the challenge because there are so many impeachable offenses on the table right now.
Subpoenas are more often issued by courts than they are by the Congress. And when they are issued by courts, there are remedies, which include fines and imprisonment. Do you think the courts are liable to get involved if, in fact, the president continues to defy subpoenas of the Congress? Is there a role for the courts?
I certainly think they should, and it's hard to predict because there are differing views, of course, on the Supreme Court about executive power. I think that my wrote a piece called Kavanaugh's Radical View of Executive Power, suggesting that that now Justice Kavanaugh really has a view of executive privilege and executive power that rejects the central principles of U.S. v. Nixon. And when you listen to him, for instance, in the hearing talk about that case, he narrowed it so that it really was about a subpoena in a criminal case by a special prosecutor. And here we're in different territory. We're in the territory, as you say, of Congress subpoenaing officials. But to me, the reason why we think U.S. v. Nixon isn't just any case, but is one of the greatest canonical cases in American history is because it stands for a broad principle that applies beyond the specifics of that case, beyond questions of special prosecutors' right to subpoena tapes in the Nixon case. And that's the simple idea that the case cites, which is that no one is so high in this country, no official is so high that they're above the law. So that certainly applies in the subpoena case by Congress as well. And Congress's power has expanded now. I mean, normally it's got to show a legislative purpose in using its subpoena power pursuant to consideration angering pieces of legislation. But once we enter the phase that we're in now of an impeachment inquiry, the subpoena power can be used for that lawful and legitimate power to investigate wrongdoing. And so the courts, in my view, should intervene and should say, yes, that this is a violation of Congress's rightful power. Now, they do have a doctrine called the political question doctrine, for instance, that sometimes they use if they don't want to get involved in a dispute between the executive and the Congress and between the other branches. But I think that would really be a betrayal of the ideal of U.S. v. Nixon.
Just a tiny bit more background on U.S. versus Nixon. Not everybody remembers, although we all know the term tapes.
Right. U.S. v. Nixon concerns a subpoena by the special prosecutor in the Watergate investigation of evidence in the ongoing Watergate trials, in which Nixon was, I believe, an unindicted co-conspirator, and he's told he has to hand over this potential evidence that will give the special prosecutor information about what actually happened in this whole break-in and related related moments, possibly criminal moments. And the president says, "I'm sorry, but I'm under Article 2, have a unique position in the United States as president, and I have executive privilege to not turn over these tapes." So then it went to the court, and the question before the court was, does the president have executive privilege to, in this case, make him immune from this subpoena? And the court, in this very bold and broad opinion, said no. The president is not above the law. The ability to investigate crimes and to investigate the president has to include the ability to get basic information from the executive branch, but also the president himself. And so they did intervene in a strong opinion, told the president, you've got to turn over these tapes. And of course, that led ultimately to, that was the beginning of the end, I think, that led to the resignation of the president.
Quinn Hillier is still with us, a columnist for the Washington Examiner, contributor to the National Review. You regard yourself as a deep and committed member of the conservative movement. What do you think are the consequences if, in fact, the president continues to defy the Congress in the way that he has, and particularly if the Supreme Court were, in an opinion written by Justice Kavanaugh or anybody else, to uphold the president's resistance? How would that go down, do you think, with the principles of conservatism as you understand them?
Well, let me first just correct the record a little bit from what the other guest just said, because I'm trying to call balls and strikes, and you know I've been really hard on the president here. Today's scheduled, now canceled testimony by the ambassador was under request. It was not under subpoena.
Okay. That was my mistake. I said subpoena. Go ahead.
Okay. And number two, it is axiomatic that the president's, you know, confidentiality privileges are greater in the realm of diplomacy than they are otherwise. So it is arguable that until there is a subpoena and until some other things have been worked out, it is understandable for the president to say, wait a minute, don't testify yet, I'm not being treated fairly. Now, I would not go down the line and say that the president has an absolute right to keep the ambassador from testifying. But right now, this is the part of the normal give and take between branches where the House is basically pushing, and the president saying, wait a minute, give me a chance here. And it is true that Nancy Pelosi has broken precedent by not having a vote, a formal vote to open an impeachment inquiry. It is true that she has not assigned a single committee to do it. And it is true that they have not adopted any formal rules governing it, which means that it's not really fair to the president, even though I think the president has done all sorts of things wrong. It's not fair to him to say, we want anybody in the executive branch to come and testify at our will when we haven't even told you what the process is or what the rules are. And so under those circumstances, we are nowhere near U.S. versus Nixon category yet. We are nowhere near an absolute presidential defiance of a legitimate congressional subpoena or anything like that. So I don't want to jump too far. I think we got to, both sides have to play by the rules. Right now, neither side is playing by the rules, and that's what's so frustrating to me.
Professor Betschneider, were you and I both then talking hypothetically and moving the ball further down the court than it's yet been moved?
Well, I mean, I was answering the question of what are we going to do in the instance in which an actual subpoena by Congress is defied, and I think there that would be an abuse of power. Now, if the, you know, we're talking about, it depends on the circumstance. We're talking about a circumstance where there's no actual subpoena, then, you know, I take the point. That's fine. But certainly if subpoenas are issued, even without a vote, I mean, I'm hearing this a lot, that there has to be some sort of formal vote by the House that then triggers the fact that we're in an impeachment inquiry. And, you know, that would be up to a court to decide. But I think that Congress has made it very clear, including the Speaker, that they're now using their lawful impeachment power, and that includes the power to investigate possible impeachment. And it's certainly not the case that they have to vote on articles of impeachment or that there has to be any formal vote, I think, to use that power. They're investigating a possible abuse of power that's within their constitutionally given, textually given right to do so. So, you know, they could try that argument if they want to defy the subpoena and go to court and say, well, this doesn't count because there hasn't been a formal vote. But I don't see that really making a difference. It's overly formalistic, and all sides of the aisle don't, I think, respond to there's no sort of magic moment where an impeachment inquiry begins.
Once again, to the charges that have been brought forth so far and the fact that the Congress is focusing on the Ukraine situation, can you be specific, Corey Betschneider, about exactly those circumstances that you think merit impeachment on a broader scale?
Well, I thought the general discussion in the first half was exactly right, that, you know, one question I should say is the legal criminal question of whether or not there's a violation of campaign finance laws by seeking aid in the campaign, namely the information here. But that's really, to me, not the heart of the matter of whether or not the president in that phone call committed a high crime and misdemeanor. That phrase is about abuse of power, abuse of office, and there's nothing to me more paradigmatically abusive of the presidential office than seeking to have a political opponent and his son either prosecuted or to seek information and dirt by relying on a foreign government. The framers were certainly worried about foreign intervention that was inappropriate. That's why we have a foreign emoluments clause. And to me, the heart of the republic is the ability to criticize, to have a legitimate opposition that isn't criminalized. And it threatens that. It threatens, it's not just a question of, you know, some specific abstract matter. It is the essence of a democracy that you have the ability to criticize a president and to not be prosecuted or persecuted using the official mechanisms of government for being a political opponent. Now, we've had moments in our history that have betrayed that ideal, including very early on the Alien and Sedition Acts that were not only signed by John Adams, but he really pursued using that legislation, his political opponents, newspaper editors in particular, who criticized him. But that's widely, rightly seen as a, and certainly a nonpartisan broad consensus that was one of the most abusive moments in our country's history. And we're seeing it again, unfortunately, with a president who just doesn't get that you can't be gone after through official mechanisms of government for criticizing the president for standing for that office. And that's why this is so dire right now.
Quinn Hillier, a final question to you. What about Joe Biden in all of this? He obviously is important to the president's theory and to the president's rhetoric about what has happened in the past. He's been accused of conflicts of interest by the president, but he, Joe Biden, hasn't really had an awful lot to say. What do you think is the consequence of that politically?
I think Joe Biden has been very badly hurt politically by this. And he's I don't understand why he has been so silent, although he's sort of between a rock and a hard place. If you protest too much, people start thinking that you're you know, that there's something funny. So I don't know exactly what he should be doing. I do know this, that he showed bad judgment by allowing himself to be the point man on Ukraine, knowing that his son had what was basically a sweetheart deal, probably was not illegal, but was a sweetheart deal with a very prominent country operating in Ukraine. He should have said, I'm sorry, my son has put me in a bad position. President Obama, make somebody else the point man here. Because what he did is he invited questions about the legitimacy of American foreign policy, even though the policy itself was good. It was bad judgment. It wasn't illegal, but he sort of put himself in a position where now it's coming back to bite him.
Quinn Hillier, again, with the Washington Examiner, also the National Review. Great to have you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Corey Brettschneider, professor once again at Brown University and now visiting at Fordham Law School. What do you think about the politics of all of this, and how damaging has it been to Joe Biden? How damaging will it continue to be as more information comes out?
I think, unfortunately, it's right that he's damaged, and the president succeeded in focusing on an issue that we shouldn't be focused on. The actions of his son, first of all, I think aren't relevant to assessing the candidate. But more seriously, you know, the really violation of the duty of office. And as I said, trying to use a foreign government to go after a political opponent, anything that comes after that, if we fall prey to thinking, OK, let's listen to the accusation. Then we're encouraging this behavior, which is really, as I said, not only outrageous, but probably one of the worst abuses of power. You have to date back to find something equivalent to Adams. And I think that it's sort of our obligation as citizens to think to ourselves, you know what, the president's trying to get us to focus on this, but we're not. We're gonna call the president out for abusing the office once again.
Corey Brettschneider, you have been very kind to be with us, and thanks so much. A new book is Oath of the Office, A Guide to the Constitution and Future Presidents. Thanks again.
Thanks. Pleasure to speak with you.
We'll be back in a moment to hear more about a previously obscure foreign country that's now central to America's latest political scandal, Ukraine. Back in a moment with To the Point. Well, we're only back again with To the Point. The impeachment of President Trump is currently focused, as we all know, on relations between the United States and Ukraine. Ukraine is often described as the former Soviet republic that's now divided between historic ties to Russia and the values of Western democracy, but it is not all that simple. Julia Yaffe is a veteran reporter, one-time Moscow correspondent. She's now writing for GQ magazine, and she's author of a recent article in that publication titled, Here's Why Ukraine Pops Up in So Many U.S. Scandals. Julia, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why does it pop up?
Oh, how long do you have? So let's start with the fact that it is, you know, I think Ukrainians don't love being positioned in this way in our discourse, but it is true. It is a former Soviet republic, and it has been at the center of a tug of war between the U.S. and Russia since early on in Vladimir Putin's two-decade reign. He has always been afraid that Ukraine would be pulled into the orbit of the West, that it would become a kind of Western democracy, which is not something that he wants to see happen, given, you know, the pro-democratic opposition forces at home. And because of this tug of war, Ukraine pops up in our newsfeed because of conflict, right? Shooting in the streets or Russia invading Ukraine and seizing a part of its territory like Crimea and illegally annexing it. But more recently, the reason is that there is a lot of money sloshing around in Ukraine. And that's also part of that Soviet heritage. when all these big industrial mines, gas wells, pipelines, all these natural resources and industrial kind of riches that were privatized, they landed in just a very small number of hands. And because also in part because of the Soviet legacy, there's very weak rule of law, very weak civil society, and corruption flourished. Mm-hmm. And because the Ukrainians want, there is a real section of Ukrainian society that wants to drift toward the West, that wants to be more democratic, that wants to be more open, transparent, and law-abiding, they hire Western political consultants to come in and help them win elections and to help them do things like polling and targeting of voters. But because there's so much money sloshing around and these oligarchic clans have so much money and want this Western window dressing of a political Western political consultant or a Western lobbyist to help them secure that contract or that aid in Washington, they're willing to pay incredibly large amounts of money that we don't see in the West. You know, Hunter Biden was allegedly paid as much as $50,000 a month just for sitting on the board of this very murky company that had kind of global ambitions and wanted a big name on its board. There's no way that Hunter Biden, who had no experience in the energy sector or in the former Soviet space, would have been paid $50,000 a month by a Western company. The same is true of Paul Manafort, who was, as you recall, Trump's campaign manager, who made nearly $13 million in cash in just 5 years working for the pro-Moscow side in Ukraine. Bernie Sanders, former chief strategist for 2016, when he was considering working there, and he did end up working there, but when he was considering working there in 2014, he demanded $10,000 a day plus travel to work there.
That's Ted Devine.
Yeah, and these are kind of cartoonish sums that you don't see that in the West that are out of all proportion to these people's expertise, what they bring to the talent. But they're kind of, I think that money is there to kind of make up for the fact that it maybe is not the cleanest money in the world, and it's kind of, you know, some sugar to help the dirty money go down.
So is this Russian money? Is it Western money in addition to being money that comes out of the energy sector in Ukraine itself?
It's all of the above. The energy sector is still very closely tied to Russia, and that money is very, has very dark provenance. So it's really all of the above. There's a lot of money coming in, you know, from Western NGOs that are trying to help the Ukrainian civil society get off the ground and become stronger. There is Western military aid, and we all know that. That's also very easy to, carve slices off of. And then there's also, it's a resource-rich country. It's an agriculturally rich country. And in a place with a lot of corruption and weak rule of law, a lot of money is, just doesn't go where it's supposed to go by the books. In the piece, I tell a story of these two young women I met in Kiev who worked at a local Prada outlet, not outlet, but a local Prada store. And I asked them who comes in, and they said, oh, one of our most regular clients is a local prosecutor, not the state prosecutor, but a local prosecutor who probably makes at most, $2,000 a month. And she went on regular shopping sprees there. And when she couldn't afford something, she would tell her daughter, that's okay, mommy will steal some more.
That's pretty revealing. Well, I happen to have visited Ukraine probably 7 or 8 years ago, something like that, for totally different reasons. I wasn't being a reporter. It had to do with my wife's heritage. And we saw Kyiv, which is not a very prosperous-looking city. And then we got on the Dnieper River, and we started down the river. And as we went along, the houses got bigger and bigger and fancier, and pretty soon we were looking at houses that looked like they were on Sunset Boulevard or something, with all kinds of cranes around and obviously other houses being built with people competing to have bigger houses than the person next door, as opposed to, on the other side of the river, these massive Soviet-style sort of barracks where you have several families all living in the same unit at the same time.
Right. Ukraine is not great in terms of income inequality or wealth disparity. And in that way, it is also very similar to Russia, which has right now the highest gap in wealth accumulation in the world. You know, more than African countries, more than China, you know, the difference in how much wealth the top and the bottom has. And Ukraine is very similar. It is because of the corruption, because of the weak rule of law, because of prosecutors who shop at Prada. The wealth isn't equally distributed. And it's funny, Kyiv is actually far more prosperous than many cities around the country. You know, if you go east, people live in, people live very poorly. I spent some time in the east of the country when fighting was breaking out there. You know, it's, people don't live well. And the conflict with Russia really tanked the currency. It really caused a lot of economic hardship for the country. So things have even, you know, have gotten even worse since then. But the people at the top have money to pay, Hunter Biden or Ted Devine or Paul Manafort, these obscene amounts of money. And what's interesting is that the revolution that brought down Viktor Yanukovych in 2014 and started off this latest round of Ukraine being in our news cycle was not just because of a tug of war between, you know, the European Union and the West and Russia. It was an anti-corruption movement. People were sick and tired of exactly this kind of corruption, where people at the top live like kings and people at the bottom do not live well at all. And there's far more people at the bottom than at the top. And this was one of the things that Joe Biden was actually, when he was in the White House, he was the Obama administration's point person, on Ukraine, this was something that he was really pressing the Poroshenko and his administration on. He was on the phone with them sometimes several times a week saying, you really got to clean up your act. You really have to address this corruption thing because it's going to bring the whole thing down and you're wasting the massive amounts of political capital you have that you accumulated in this, glorious revolution where a bunch of young people came together and swept out the old corrupt guys. And that's why Viktor Shokin, that prosecutor general, was fired. And it's true that it wasn't just Biden who wanted him out. In fact, he really wasn't even investigating the company that Hunter Biden worked for. But as you can tell, this is a super tangled web.
Well, so President Trump, of course, says he, too, is mainly concerned about corruption in Ukraine. And he's particularly focused on this company, Burisma, that Hunter Biden worked for, even though it wasn't perhaps under investigation at the time. What do we know about what Hunter Biden got in exchange for $50,000 a month?
I don't know that we know all that much. I think also somebody, and I'm not speaking specifically to Hunter Biden, but I think somebody like Hunter Biden in that kind of position wouldn't be expected to do a hell of a lot other than sit there and, allow his name to be printed on the materials and perhaps introduce them to people in the Democratic establishment. That's also what Ted Devine was there for and what Paul Manafort was there for, which was to, introduce them to the Republican establishment and to lobby for them in Washington and put a good face on all of the corruption and shady dealings that were going on. But I do want to emphasize, Burisma wasn't being investigated by Shokin. That was kind of one of the problems. Shokin was using his office, if this sounds familiar to your listeners today, the prosecutor general was using his office to go after the president, the new president's political opponents, and to protect, you know, his friends. And that was one of the reasons the IMF wanted this prosecutor out. The Europeans wanted him out. The State Department wanted him out. You know, the Congress wanted him out. There were, Biden was just kind of delivering the message that this guy is not only not pursuing corruption cases, but making it worse.
So President Trump and Rudy Giuliani, his attorney, sort of seem to be taking a different side with regard to the issues in Ukraine. And you have a wonderful, you end your piece with a wonderful line, which is, we become unwitting participants in somebody else's games. Is that what's going on here?
Well, it's something that often happens where, because of all the complexities and all these clan battles that are happening in Ukraine, because it's hard to keep up with. Americans are very, we're very self-absorbed and self-centered as a country. And so it becomes much easier to say, those are the good guys who are pro-Western anti-corruption. These are the bad guys who are pro-Russian and pro-corruption. And that's easy. And we can just move on. When in fact, those categories often bleed together and the Venn diagram often looks like a circle. But here, I think we're smushing Ukraine into a new hole. We're saying, okay, so this guy was actually fighting in our political battles, that they were interfering in our elections, that Vice President Biden was protecting his son, that we were kind of fighting our political battles over here and that they were fighting our political battles here, which is not really at all what happened. You know, these are conspiracy theories that the president and his and the people around him are latching onto because they justify what he's doing and validate his increasingly warped division of the world and the United States. And Ukraine is just, you know, it's an easy cudgel with which to do it. And they, in some ways, have to play along because they're really dependent on our aid to fight the Russians, who are still, you know, holding, they have still annexed this chunk of territory. There's still this bloody stalemate in the East. They really need this aid, and they're kind of hostage to our politics, which is really unfortunate.
What about the charges that Ukraine was, in fact, the country that hacked into the 2016 election here in the United States?
I don't know the details of it. I know that it has been discredited by all of U.S. intelligence, every credible journalistic outlet. Yeah, it's kind of hard. I think there's a trap that you fall into with these conspiracy theories is, in order to debunk them, you have to describe them, and then you just give them more oxygen. You're still, you know, repeating that debunked version of events. So I try not to kind of repeat and get into them and to not give them more traction.
That was terrific. You are in deep. Thank you so much for giving us the background on that. Julia Yaffe, great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Previtari. You can catch our latest To the Point climate change update with journalist and scholar Elizabeth Culbert. She is warning about massive extinctions of fish and plants and animals. Human activity is making them vanish so fast it's almost comparable to the asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. You can find that and all of our other episodes on your favorite podcasting app. And do this. Contact us on social media. Tweet us at tothepoint_KCRW. Leave a review. Contact me directly at warren.olney@kcrw.org. Or tweet me at warrenolney1. We want to know what you think and what you'd like to hear. Thanks for being with us this time, and come back again.